This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Know your audience. That's something that writers and performers are told all the time. It's also important for teachers to not only know their audience, but to know how to talk to them. It's called culturally tailored education, and it's an approach that's being used around the country to bring important information about health to a racially diverse population.
We go to them wherever they live. We educate them wherever they are.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the director of one of these programs in Western New York State. We'll also spend an academic minute learning what academics do when they're not academicing. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Culturally tailored education. Once you learn about the concept, it's strange that we haven't heard more about it. And for the most part, teachers know who their students are and how to talk to them so the lesson gets through. But as we all know, not all teaching goes on in the classroom. Dr. Deborah Irwin is a medical anthropologist and the director of the Office of Cancer Health Disparities Research at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. Last summer, her department received a pair of grants from Susan B. Komen of Western New York to continue their culturally tailored education to different ethnic and racial groups of women. The lessons, how to detect breast cancer, and if you find disease, what to do about it. I spoke with Dr. Irwin about those grants and the educational programs they fund. Well, let's talk about that first grant, which is about the culturally tailored education for a screening for breast cancer. Where do you begin with something like that, and who are your targets?
Well, we are focused on African-American women, Hispanic, and in the case of Buffalo and most of Western New York, that many of those are Puerto Rican women, and then also low-income, uninsured women in urban areas particularly. So we have two outreach programs that are what we call evidence-based. It means they have been researched and proven to be effective. One is the Witness Project, and the other is Esperanza y Vida. And Esperanza y Vida means hope in life. And they are kind of sister programs. One is tailored for Hispanic women. One is tailored for African-American women and also urban women in the Buffalo area and in Niagara Falls. And we have teams, we have some staff members, but then we have a host of volunteers that are trained from the community. So we have these great collaborations with the Witness Project, and these are African-American women. Many of them are survivors. Some are just advocates for breast cancer screening. And they go and do educational programs in faith-based locations, many times in churches. The steering committee for it is a group of First Ladies of Western New York who are the pastor's wives of a group of about 8 African-American churches. So many of these are faith-based, but we also work with the Buffalo Municipal Housing Authority and any of the housing groups in the area and do education and then set them up for appointments for screening.
So you have advocates going out into the community and just trying to bring people in, right?
Right. We go to them wherever they live. We educate them wherever they are. All the programs are keyed to low literacy issues. A lot of it's oral presentation, and particularly with both Esperanza and with Witness, there are survivors that talk about their experiences and serve as role models and say, you know, I've been through cancer and I've survived and I'm here to talk to you about these issues, and part of my mission is to make sure I get every woman I can find that is 40 and older screen for breast cancer. And so they're very credible messengers with a very strong message that's very well received. And we've been able to demonstrate that just the educational programs alone can increase screening up to 28-30%. And then if we add the navigation of helping women actually make the appointments, calling them back, we do a little assessment when we do the educational program to see if someone is eligible for screening and what their insurance status is. And then if they don't have insurance, the navigators can connect them and help them apply for and get eligibility through the New York State Cancer Services Program to provide screening. And they will provide mammography screening as well as workups for any abnormals.
it has to be important to have these advocates out there who, these aren't faces on a TV screen. There's a, here I am, I'm flesh and blood, I had it, I survived. That really must help people.
Oh, absolutely. And it's much better than having a clinician, actually. I mean, there are some effective programs that have shown that doctors going into the community can be effective as well. But having local community volunteers and other African-American women that are just like the women in the community talk about their personal experience. Narrative communication is what we call that, and it's extremely effective. It kind of helps promote the idea that, oh, this could happen to me, and it also counters some of the arguments women have. Well, I don't have time. I don't, blah, blah. All of the excuses that they have can be countered by these women who have the same issues that they do, because life gets in the way. And a lot of these African-American women, particularly between 40 and 60, who are some of the highest risk, are so busy helping take care of their families and other people that they're not taking care of themselves. So this is really an important message for them to hear.
When they are out speaking to members of the community, are they just talking about coming in to get screening, or are they talking about self-examination? How much education is going either way?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the powers that be, both the U.S. Preventive Services Task Forces and the Komen Foundation and others, have suggested that breast self-examination is not something we need to promote very much, that it's not going to change survival. However, that many of those studies were done with other populations. And for the African-American women, they do still talk about breast self-examination, and they do still talk about being an advocate for yourself. And one of the reasons we still promote that is that there is some published literature and research that demonstrates that women who are performing breast self-examination and will take that step are then more likely to go on to get a mammogram. And for women that we reach that are only 30 or 35, sometimes that is all they have, is a breast self-examination, because they don't qualify for mammography. And unless they are from a high-risk family, they don't qualify for any other type of care or MRI or other diagnostic procedures. So it's very important that women are aware. And then if they're aware at 30, then when it comes time for them to actually be eligible at 40 for screening, they're more likely to go on and do that. So they do. They talk about the risk factors for breast cancer. They talk about the symptoms of breast cancer in case somebody does already have a symptom. And then they talk about how to examine their breasts and the fact that they should be sure to get a clinical breast exam by their nurse practitioner or their primary care physician when they do see them, and that they then also need to get their scripts, the prescription, from the primary care doctor or the nurse practitioner in order to get the mammogram.
How are these presentations tailored culturally? Is it just because you have African American women speaking to African American women, or is there a different type of, say,
well,
script?
Well, that's an excellent, excellent question. And that's a very interesting concern for all of us that do culturally tailored outreach. And no, it is not just the fact that it's an African American face that's there doing it, although race concordance and ethnic concordance for the Hispanic program is kind of an essential baseline. It doesn't have to be. And you can have white women at the programs as well, but that's a key component. That's kind of a baseline. Then over and beyond that, the Witness Project programs, they say they have church wherever they go. So they start out the programs with a hymn. They often have a prayer, and then they talk about that. And when the women talk about their experiences, almost all of the survivors always refer to their own spiritual faith journey through the cancer, the role God and Holy Spirit and or their own faith had in the process, how they are now talking about this process and this program and the screening issue because they feel called by God to give something back after having survived breast cancer. And so it has a very strong spiritual component. Now, the Esperanza y Vida Project doesn't have quite as much discussion, open discussion of the spirituality. They don't necessarily start with a hymn or prayer. They're obviously most of the time in Spanish. The programs are in Spanish or English, depending on the preferences of the participants. But they also provide information for the family. And many of the Hispanic programs, particularly when we tested this intervention, Esperanza y Vida, we did it in Arkansas and in New York, and particularly for newer immigrant women, particularly Mexican women or Dominican or any of the women that are more recently immigrated, there's a strong patriarchal social structure. And so oftentimes we do the programs to include the men. And they also, often the Hispanic programs and some of the Witness Project programs, have children there. So we're allowing anybody to come. They're there. Everything is kind of family-oriented, particularly for most of the Esperanza y Vida programs.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Deborah Irwin continues with a look at the second grant program, What to Do If a Screen Comes Back Positive. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Deborah Irwin, a medical anthropologist and the director of the Office of Cancer Health Disparities Research at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. We're talking about the center's culturally tailored health screening programs. The first project had to do with helping culturally diverse populations screen for breast cancer. The second project takes these women through the next steps if a test comes back positive.
That's a real significant issue. Many physicians are very aware of this and providers, but I'm not sure as much of the public is aware that a lot of times women will get an abnormal finding and they either don't understand the report that they got that says they have an abnormal and need to be calling their doctor and having follow-up, especially if they don't read, or if they speak Spanish and it comes in English, they either have to have somebody else translate it for them. And so the report goes to the physician, it should be going to their primary care physician too, but depending on whether they have an electronic medical record, they have a way to really spot these, et cetera, sometimes they just kind of slip between the cracks and the women don't really respond and do anything right away. So one of the things we want to do is that any woman that has an abnormal, and when we're doing any of our screenings, particularly for the Hispanic women that are Spanish-speaking, the outcome for that test goes back to the woman that helped navigate her into the screening service so that she will call the woman back, explain over the phone, did you get this letter? Do you know what it means? This is what you need to do, and we need to make an appointment for you. They sometimes have an MRI, they may have an ultrasound, they may have something else, but whatever the additional tests need to be done, and then following from that into actually seeing a surgeon or medical oncologist or whoever the physician is they need to see.
Putting that third party in the middle there, do you have some kind of privacy HIPAA thing you've got to get around?
Well, we do, and only because the outreach community, it's usually a staff person, but either the staff person is usually the person that calls the woman back, not a community volunteer. So we have a limit as to who receives those reports back. And yes, that is controlled by HIPAA. But since we have brought the women to the program, when they sign, we have them sign that says, yes, you can contact me in the future. And they voluntarily give us the information about their personal health information so that we can call them back.
Have you been doing this long enough where you could see that there are successes?
Oh, we have definitely been doing the screening long enough. Now, in terms of the navigation here at Roswell Park for the African-American and Hispanic women and having culturally concordant navigators for them, we have a history of being able to do this for the African-American women in the past. We have not had a Hispanic woman in the past, a navigator for these women. So we don't have any history on that. With the African-Americans, one of the things that we noted right away is that we ended up having, of the women that were navigated, that we had a significant reduction in no-shows for appointments. So one of the things is when you get a cancer diagnosis, it's not quite like other chronic diseases require you to go back, and you go back routinely, like diabetes or high blood pressure. But with cancer, you end up having to see a lot of different doctors. The series that you go to the doctors can be important. You have to have tests done before you see certain doctors. There's a lot of points in the, in fact, there's publications that show there are up to 50 decision points a woman has to make about a breast cancer diagnosis. So it's a very challenging process to get through. And if you don't have very high health literacy, meaning you can read things that are sent out to you from the clinic, you can read the medicine bottles, you can read the consent forms for the protocols and for the treatment, it's very challenging, and women get totally overwhelmed. And if you don't have a car and you don't have transportation, or you have to rely on someone else for that, and you're taking care of your kids or your grandkids or working, it's very challenging to meet all of those appointments, recognize what you need to do, follow through, and be what on the healthcare side people call compliant. So they'll say, oh, well, this patient's not compliant. Well, it's not that the patient isn't compliant. It's the patient is overwhelmed by the process and isn't able to really cope and manage all of that, because it's a full-time job to get yourself through a cancer diagnosis and treatment.
We're speaking about this in the Buffalo, New York, Western New York area. Is this going on nationally? Are similar programs going on around the country?
Yes. And in fact, there was NIH funding for a large, I'm not exactly sure, probably 12 to 15 different navigation studies about 10 years ago, maybe 9 years ago. And in that process, we got a lot of really good data and evidence for the effectiveness of navigation, of getting people in for their first visits, of getting them in more timely manner, and in what is required to take place for an effective navigational relationship. And so that's been very helpful. And a lot of places around the U.S. are doing this. One of the challenges is a lot of hospitals and healthcare programs haven't seen whether or not this is cost effective. So some of them have been hesitant to do this because they think, oh, maybe it's not cost effective. But I think the newest information and research that's coming out of partially through the Affordable Care Act shows that having what they're called hot spotters, which is kind of like what a navigation process is giving special resources to the folks that need it the most to be able to get through their treatment process and what needs to happen so that you have better patient outcomes. It's easier for the patient. It's easier for the physician and the medical staff. And the patients are so much happier. So the quality of life during treatment and post-treatment is much better, and it's really more cost-effective because the patient navigators don't have to be nurse navigators. Some places do have nurse navigators, but a lot of the published research shows that lay navigators can be just as effective as a nurse-trained navigator, because what they're doing is they're assessing patients when they come in and finding out if Ms. Jones needs transportation help, calling them the night before an appointment and saying, now you're scheduled to come, you know, the taxi is going to be there or whoever's going to be there. We've made the arrangements for the transportation. Do you have any other issues that are happening? And then that's when you find out, oh, her husband's just had a stroke and she doesn't want to come or whatever's happening, and then being able to navigate that. Other things are like being able to help the woman make sure that she has lined up the appointments in a way that she can generally make it. You know, a lot of times appointment process is geared to the clinical staff and the clinical calendar, and they don't realize that, oh, this woman has a radiology appointment the day before, and then she's supposed to come back to have another lab test done here. And a navigator can help get those appointments on the same day and be able to help her with that. And a lot of places are recognizing that this kind of service is very effective and needs to be. And I think that's the intent from Komen for awarding these several navigation grants, these two-year grants that they're doing, is to get more of these programs started so that places like Roswell will pick it up and carry it forward.
But it all goes back to the beginning. It all begins with the education. So navigator to educator, or the other way around, educator to navigator, I guess.
Right. And then also, there's another little role that it's hard to specify what it is, but the navigator also, both whether it's in the screening process, the education programs we do with Esperanza y Vida and Witness, or whether they're handing someone off to the navigator, one of the other things is that it's very important that we teach patients how to interact with the healthcare system and their healthcare providers. And so, particularly for minority women, one of the things that both the education programs and the outreach and the navigator help do is to help women assert themselves and to be assertive and to say what their needs are or what their issues are, or if they have a problem with something, not just to nod and then do what they are going to do, but to say, I have a problem with this, or why are you doing this, and asking questions and finding out, because assertive patients actually have better outcomes and prove to be, in most cases, better patients in terms of compliance than patients that are just not really engaged in the process.
Dr. Deborah Irwin is a medical anthropologist and the director of the Office of Cancer Health Disparities Research at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. So somebody tells you they're an academic. What the heck does that mean? Okay, they're probably a teacher, but what do they do when they're not teaching? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Just what do academics do when they're not teaching? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Martin Krieger, professor of planning at the University of Southern California, sheds light on the life of academics when they're not standing in front of the classroom.
Professors live curious lives. Very little of what we do is shown to others, at least when we are doing it. Of course, we teach courses, typically two full courses each semester. Courses need to be prepared. Students need attention about the course, but also about their lives and dreams. Papers need to be graded. And we attend meetings about the governance of our departments and the university, as well as seminars where we learn of others' work. But most of the time, no one is keeping track of us at all. If we are in a university that is committed to the scholarly life, as is often described in Academic Minute, we spend a large fraction of our lives in scholarly work. We need to actually do that work in the library and archives, in laboratories and in the field. We need to raise funds to pay for the costs of research. We need to train the next generation of scholars. And we need to disseminate what we learned through writing and publishing, through meetings with colleagues throughout the world. So every few years we are asked, what have you done lately? And the answer is in terms of ongoing projects, published books and articles, students trained and grants received, and lectures given about our work. Most productive scholars work many more than 40 hours each week, willingly. Yes, there are scholars who are not productive or who teach very little. And in universities where teaching plays a predominant role, there's less time for scholarship. But the academic life enables us to give our students the fruits of our collective scholarly labors, and to give society the fruits of our thinking and invention.
That was Martin Krieger of the University of Southern California. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website, go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.